I'm going to talk today about the future of love, which sort of involves talking about the future of sex, too. But I'm focusing on love for now. This talk actually grew out of a post that I wrote on io9, which is a science fiction and science blog that I run all day and all night, and then also in an alternate universe. So it's basically all my time here and in that place that people go on the TV show Fringe. What I've done is I've developed some scenarios for where love might go about 100 years from now, and they're heavily influenced by science fiction. So as I talk about this, I'll be bringing in some examples from science fiction as well as sort of current political trends. But I want to start out, since we're talking about something that's pretty complicated, which is love, by just offering a few quick... Am I going to block this? I don't really care. I want to offer a few quick ways of thinking about what love is, because I think probably everyone has their own definitions. So here are some of the tools that I'm going to use to talk about love. First of all, I think probably most of the people in this room are familiar with the idea that love, or what we refer to love, is basically a social construction, which is to say that love is not some eternal, spiritual kind of thing that transcends humanity and that we can never define. It's actually, in fact, something that different cultures have defined in different ways over time, and that the way that we think of love is contingent on where we live and who our friends are and what kind of political regime that we've grown up under. So as just a basic example of how the social construction of love works, my definition of love here in San Francisco right now as a member of the middle class and as a member of the sex community is basically that, love is something I can choose to do with pretty much anybody I want, as long as they're consenting. That's one of those sex community things we like, consent. That's very different from what my ancestors 400 years ago living in a shtetl somewhere in Poland would have thought love was. For them, love might have involved an arranged marriage or some kind of affair, but it wouldn't have been perceived as something that you could do with anyone, anytime, midnight after a hookup on Craigslist or whatever. So that's a really different, right there, a very, very different notion of what love is. And so feeding into that idea of love as a social construction is obviously that definitions of love are historically contingent, which is, again, that they change over time, that what one group of people thinks of as love is going to be completely different from what another group thinks. And even within the same time, obviously, you get, people, I don't know, I watched this show called Glee. And in the show, probably a lot of people do. There's a celibacy club at the high school where the Glee Club is. And so obviously the kids in the celibacy club, think of love very differently than somebody, say, again, in the sex community might. I think in the celibacy club, probably ideally, they think of love going together with sex. Like, you never would have sex outside of love, and you'd probably never have love outside of marriage. Here in the San Francisco sex community, we think of love and sex, they might sometimes pass in the night, but they aren't necessarily the same thing, and nor should they have to be the same thing. Now, the other thing about love, though, and I think a lot of other people today have already addressed this, in pretty granular detail, which is that love is also a neurochemical process. It's a biological process. It's been studied. There's actually a couple of really great resources if you want a quick look at what biologists and neuroscientists think about love. There's a book called Why We Love by Helen Fisher, which got a lot of media attention a couple years ago. It's a little bit of a cheesy book, but it comes out of her studies of putting people in fMRIs while they think about somebody who they're really passionately, almost obsessed with. So it's kind of like very intense, lusty love. And she did discover that there were some very common patterns that showed up in people's brains, that many people were processing that feeling in roughly the same regions of their brain. And there's also another really great book called A General Theory of Love, which was actually written a few years ago by a group of doctors over at UC San Francisco who talk more about neurochemical processes like or even just chemical processes, like people's heart rates slow down when they're in the presence of someone that they love. When people sleep together for a long time, they tend to regulate each other's breathing and things like that. And so they've done a lot of scientific experiments looking at couples who've been together for a long time and how their bodies respond to each other. So we know that love is connected to certain biological processes. And these processes, unlike the historical and social constructions of love, are kind of unchanging. They change with evolution, and you know, maybe after the singularity, they'll be very, very different. But in terms of our own history, and in terms of the time period that we've been keeping track of culture, probably the biological processes of love haven't changed all that much. The heart palpitations, the feeling of calm when you're with someone that you love, all of that kind of stuff is basically a human constant. So, you know, like Rome falls, but love goes on. The American Empire falls, love goes on. So love is both historically contingent and socially constructed, but it's also an eternal biological fact so far as we know. So with that in mind, I want to read to you a couple of these, actually three of these case histories of what love might look like in 100 years, roughly 100 years. I didn't, you know, plot this out to the day, but I was sort of imagining based on current events and reading a lot of science fiction where love might go. I'm going to read to you, I'll just read these two and then talk a little bit about where they come from. So let's start out with a case history that probably many of you will recognize since we all live about 100 years in the future here in San Francisco anyway. So each of these scenarios, I've given the names of the people in them, I've given them variables for names. So this first scenario is about A. So A discovers sex and love roughly at the same time among his group of friends. Some of them he's met at school, others are people he knows from social networks. He and his friends don't think of hooking up and dating and being friends as different things. It's really hard to say where one ends and the other begins. As a result, A has sex, which is as casual as meeting up over coffee, and friendships that are as intense as first love, and vice versa. When he grows up, he starts to think about settling down and having a family, and his models for love and intimacy are based on what he experienced when he was younger. He considers love, friendship, and sex to be overlapping and interchangeable. For several years, he lives with three close friends. He has sex with two of them some of the time, and eventually one of them decides to get pregnant. The two of them decide to become a monogamous couple to raise the child, but remain living with their other two friends. Years pass, and A and the mother of his child both fall in love with other friends. They decide to form a polyamorous marriage, where they remain a couple, but also have other long-term relationships too. Their two housemates have sex with each other once in a while, but start fighting. One of them moves out, and a new friend moves in. A winds up having sex with the new housemate one night when his two long-term lovers are off vacationing with their kids. And so that's the end of A's story. So somewhere off in the future, A is having awesome sex right now. So where would a scenario like this come from in 100 years? I mean, this is a fairly optimistic scenario. It's based on the idea that social liberalism of the kind that we enjoy here in the Bay Area will continue to develop and perhaps spread outward into other parts of the country and the world. It also assumes that a lot of the changing norms around monogamous marriage that we've already seen taking place here in the United States will continue to change. So not only is divorce commonplace, not only is gay marriage commonplace, but polyamorous marriage becomes commonplace. You get like weird new kinds of configurations of relationships like this diagram that I have up here on the slide, which I actually stole off of Wikipedia. They actually said I could steal it. But this is a sort of weird model of what group marriages might look like in the future. The other thing that I was assuming in this model, which might not be immediately obvious, is that it assumes that there's going to be some kind of economic necessity for people to live together in groups. And so not only will people have friendship networks of the kind that we develop online all the time through horrible things like Facebook and not so horrible things like Twitter, but people will actually start basing their living arrangements on that, not because they think it's super nifty, but partly because it's necessary, because in order to afford a house, you might need to have four or five people get together and participate in paying the mortgage, which is, again, already the case here in San Francisco, and it's why we have tenancy and common laws, because it's basically impossible for just one or two people to afford a house. I do have an update status. Wow. Checking for update fail. Oh, no. Okay. Thank you for helping me out with my update there, Johannes. So in the end, the combination of a kind of, let's say, diminishing of the middle class, so an alteration in housing conditions, a continuation of social liberalism, what we'll get is kind of... we'll get sort of long-term relationships that are romantic, that look more like friendships. Some of them will be casual, some of them will be intense. There won't be this kind of rigid distinction between friendship and romantic relationship. And I think one of the interesting ways to think about love in this situation is that not that love, as I said, is this kind of eternal, beautiful thing, but that it's actually a kind of emotional tactic that emerges in any given social situation to sort of fit that social situation. So if your culture is heading more toward liberalization and redefinitions of marriage and new kinds of friendship and kinship structures, love will emerge in ways that suits those structures. And so people will start experiencing what they refer to as love in new contexts. So they won't just think, oh, well, love can only take place with one person in a long-term situation. They'll say, like, well, you know, I can be in love with a couple friends, or maybe I would prefer to live with a friend and share my life with a friend and only have love with people who are kind of outside and far away, because it's a little too intense and icky to, like, live around people that I love, because, you know, love is too intense. And so basically, love changes as our social networks change. This idea runs rampant in science fiction. Anyone here who's read any tiny portion of science fiction written since the 1960s has encountered this idea of kind of polyamorous marriage and people having more casual friendship relationships that lead to families. Everybody from Robert Heinlein to Ursula Le Guin and Charlie Strauss and Octavia Butler have written about this. Ian M. Banks writes about this all the time, along with a lot of other awesome things. I just read the new Ian M. Banks novel, and it totally rocks, by the way. It's called Transition. And it has a lot of cross-dimensional sex. Sorry, this is just like a random plug for the new Ian M. Banks novel, but transdimensional sex is the wave of the future. So let's move on to another scenario. This is the female scarcity scenario, and we're going to meet our friend B. B is always one of four girls in her classes at school. Everybody else is a boy. At first, this seems normal, but when they all go through puberty and she starts to realize that she is the focus of intense attention from all those hormone-charged boys, things change. In the country where she lives, girls are considered less valuable than boys, but you'd never know it based on how the young men treat her. In fact, B manages to grow up believing that girls are more special than boys, because after all, she and other young women are the object of fascination and desire among their peers wherever they go. In college, B falls in love for the first time after going on hundreds of dates and being told no less than 24 times that she's broken some young man's heart. She's received gifts and plaintive love letters and strange homages, but all of it made her feel weird and slightly guilty until at last she meets a man who shares her passion for puzzle games. Of course, it's hard for her to know what men are thinking. That's why B's romance almost didn't bloom. On their first date, she tells him all about her favorite kinds of word puzzles and her college classes and where she grew up, and he just nods and smiles like all the other young men did. Occasionally, she can pry some detail out of him about himself, but half the time when he's talking about himself, he's really talking about his family, or demurring that her opinions on most things are probably more informed than his. Finally, though, she challenges him to a game of chess and sees that they actually do have something in common. Years later, he admits that he waited by the phone almost constantly, waiting for her to call about a second date. But she was busy with exams and didn't manage to get back to him for 5 days. While she finds having a steady boyfriend a relief, at least she isn't pressured all the time by the other men anymore, Her female roommates in college are enjoying playing the field. They go to meetups and matchup balls and speed date events, amused by all the ways the men get gussied up and try to grab their attention. Her friends explain with bursts of giggles that some men prefer each other's company to these awkward competitions, and there are bars and clubs where no woman ever goes. She only hears rumors of them. So there's, we'll just leave B in her happy relationship where she isn't playing the field anymore. So where would a scenario like this come from? This comes out of current trends that we're seeing already in countries like China, where an access to, oh, here's my update again. It'll just come back. But luckily my slides are pretty simple. So this comes out of, like I said, access to biotechnology, as well as residual traditional cultures which embrace ideas from patriarchy. And when I say patriarchy, I don't mean the sort of giant sort of thing that we call patriarchy in feminist studies, but the literal belief that, you know, fathers and sons are the most important part of the family, just the strict old school kind of patriarchy. Already we know from one generation in China of having population controls combined with access to biotechnology that allows people to selectively abort girls, combined with a culture that, you know, values men more than women, which results in the selective abortion of girls. We know that that's resulted in an incredibly skewed population in some regions of China. In some areas, in rural areas especially, there's as much as 150 men to every 100 women. But then in more urban areas like Shanghai, there's almost no difference at all. So it's obviously very uneven. But we know that that this can happen very quickly when you have that combination of traditional values combined with accelerating biotechnology. So the interesting thing about this, and again, this is a very optimistic scenario for what might happen to a culture that has such a skew, is that if you have a combination of this skewed gender ratio combined with what we're already seeing in places like China and India and other developing nations where women are also gaining access to the middle class and to education and to professional middle class jobs, you're going to have a situation where you kind of have this weird ideological clash where women are gaining power, but at the same time they exist in a traditional culture that devalues them. And so you're not going to have necessarily a kind of handmaid's tale scenario, which I think a lot of people imagine when they think of a gender skew like this, where there's fewer men and access to women is difficult. I think the dystopian idea is that women will become property and men will enslave them and that they won't be allowed to run around and things like that. I think that if women continue to gain power, that you might indeed have this kind of gender role reversal, where not so much like gender role reversal where like women are the breadwinners and men stay home and take care of the babies, although that would be kind of interesting too. But instead, a role reversal in terms of just which sex gets fetishized, which gender gets fetishized, who feels like they need to put on a display in order to attract a mate, basically. So you get a kind of 1950s gender scenario, a Western 1950s gender scenario where, you know, women waited by the phone and women felt that they needed to dress a certain way to attract a man. But instead, in this future, it would be men who would be in that situation because they would be at such a great disadvantage. So they would be attempting to, you know, have cosmetic enhancements, and when they went on dates, they would be anxious to hide their own opinions because they wouldn't want to drive off their potential wife. So one of the really interesting places this shows up in science fiction is Ian MacDonald's books about India. Ian MacDonald is a really great writer who's originally from Ireland, and he has a new book of short stories out called Cyberabad Days, which is based in his universe that he created for another book called River of Gods, which is about a futuristic India. And among the many interesting futurist scenarios he spins out in these books, he does talk about what happens when you have a gender skew like this in your population while also having women who have some social and economic power. And he has a great story in Cyberabad Days about this guy who's trying to get a girlfriend and how he gets his teeth whitened and gets a special assistant to help him learn how to dress right, and he goes to these meetups and speed date events and goes on dates and is incredibly anxious about it, and then winds up marrying his male roommate instead. Which is great. It's a very beautiful story. It's really well done. So I kind of stole from that liberally for this particular scenario. All right, let's look at our final scenario for all you steampunks. Neo-courtly love. So our final, our new friends in this scenario are C and D. C and D are raised in an affluent community where everyone goes to church, elders are respected, and a king rules the land. From a young age, C and D have known that they are promised to each other as husband and wife. It was arranged by the priest and the community's prominent families before they were born. All marriages are arranged, except among the poor, and C and D have only seen the favelas from a distance when they pass through the community gates in a tram to travel to a neighboring town or air station. Nobody expects C and D to love each other, least of all, C and D. They will certainly make a home together, raise children, and take care of each other's parents when the time comes, but they will seek love outside the bounds of marriage. They call it courtly love, after the medieval notion that marriage is for duty and romance happens in highly codified, covert ways that everybody knows about but politely pretends not to. C and D are married when they turn 16, and their families buy them a small starter house in the heart of town near the shopping mall. C works in her mother's hat shop, and D is going to school to become a biotech entrepreneur, just like his father. Although C and D like each other, they cannot imagine a romantic spark growing between them. Passion has no place in an orderly home. And so they both discover love a few years after they are married. C meets an intense young man from outside the community who aspires to one day own his own home. He works in the mall as a physician's apprentice, and C's effortless money-bought beauty embodies everything he hopes to have for himself one day. He sends her secret poems via an encrypted channel. They meet in places nobody will ever find them. D knows that she has a lover, but as long as it never interferes with family dinners and she leaves no clues anywhere, he's happy. D has a lover too, a waitress who works at the gentleman's club where he goes with his father. She always serves him port with a salacious smile, and his liaison with her is looked upon as the sweet folly of a young man. So where would this kind of scenario come from? This comes out of a society that may evolve in a direction of traditionalism, somewhat like the society we were talking about with B. But also a society that's extremely class stratified and has a lot of isolation between different communities. It's also a society that's infused with traditions that they no longer really respect. So kind of like a community that pays lip service to tradition, but at the same time doesn't mind breaking some rules, kind of like Catholicism during the medieval period, which is when courtly love was kind of at its height. So one way that this might come about, one possibility is that as we see traditional cultures from the Middle East blending with more what we think of as more modern cultures in the West, you might see communities like this coming up where people want to maintain their ties to tradition, but at the same time they want to, have modern experiences of sex and love. And this is, again, really predicated on the idea of having a wealthy elite class that would participate in it. Courtly love, for those of you who didn't study, medieval culture for fun or in school, came out of basically the aristocracy where people didn't have much else to do other than kind of have arranged marriages and then play at court with other people. And there was a highly codified notion of what courtly love was. It was always outside marriage and involved lots of pain and love letters. And so you would see something like this, I think, coming out of a culture where there was a small elite ruling class and then a tremendously huge lower class where, among the elites, there were a lot of traditions to uphold, but at the same time, people have enough money and enough free time that they kind of develop these fetishistic love relationships outside of marriage. I think some of the science fiction that plays into this notion of what the future might be like is in fact steampunk and other kinds of science fiction that blend historical eras. I think one of the big reasons why steampunk is appealing to people is that it demonstrates what happens when you have a combination of technology and futurism and a 19th century sensibility. And although Courtly Love is of course a medieval sensibility, which is arguably different from a Victorian one, it's that same idea of, what if we have uneven social values in the future, where we kind of have these incredibly wealthy, high-tech people, but at the same time, they're participating and wanting to uphold traditions that grow out of really, really ancient cultures. So what I want to end with, or the idea that I want to end with, and what I'm trying to get at in all of these scenarios, is I want to kind of go back to this idea of love as an emotional tactic. And why we experience love in certain ways at certain times. In each of these scenarios, people are experiencing love directly as a result of the kinds of strictures in their societies, and they're either finding love within those strictures or they aren't. This is particularly obvious when you look at the neo-courtly love scenario, where you're talking about a very traditional culture that has strong regimented ideas about what men and women should do and who should get married. And so either in a culture like that, love can be one of two things. Either you can fall in love the way you're supposed to, which in, say, C&D's case in the neo-courtly love scenario would be like choosing to actually fall in love with the person that their parents had told them to marry and that the church had told them to marry, and keeping their love within that socially circumscribed little container. Or they can choose to engage in courtly love or neo-courtly love and have these outside relationships, which are directly produced by all those strictures and are kind of not just an escape from those strictures, because of course courtly love is a kind of escapism. When you're married to someone you don't love, having courtly love outside the marriage is emotional escapism, but it's also a protest against social structures, and it's a protest against the way in which the culture is prescribing that love should happen. And I think that that's true of love in almost any culture and almost any scenario. You're going to see people who love the way they are supposed to, like say in our culture, who get into a heterosexual monogamous marriage and they love the person they're supposed to love. Or there's people who love in a protest way. They love the people they're not supposed to love. They do the Romeo and Juliet thing. They fall in love with the person their family doesn't like. They fall in love with the gender or the species that they're not supposed to fall in love with. They like the anime version of the cat instead of the cyborg version, which is why I have a picture here from the anime Appleseed. This is an incredibly romantic relationship that you're looking at between a woman and a cyborg who are also warriors. And so I want to leave you with that thought, that because love is a kind of emotional tactic, that it can be a tactic that helps to subjugate or that helps people to protest against the social structures in which love is supposed to take place. So I will end there. Ooh, you have your own microphone.
I have my own one, yeah.
Awesome.
So it's a power struggle, It's also, ladies and gentlemen, like beloved members of the court, any questions for Anna Lee? Lady Anna Lee, actually, in this like.
In the neo courtly love court.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So on your female scarcity example, I was thinking, maybe extrapolating on that, it might be that cultures that are known for having a beautiful woman, I've read that there's some problems in Ukraine that people go there just to see the beautiful woman, that they might embrace biotechnology and create more women to deal with the fewer women that are in another culture, that actually might be not as a, and that they would be treated as property rather than given power in the middle class, as you indicated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's always a possibility, right? When you have female scarcity, either you can have, I mean, there's two extreme possibilities. And then there's, of course, the realistic middle ground. But one extreme is that, yeah, women would become property. But then the other possibility is that if you saw the trends that we're witnessing today, which is that women in many parts of China are entering into the professional middle class, they're getting jobs in biotech and IT, and we're meeting them at conferences all the time, especially here in California. And at the same time, they're living in cultures where there's a scarcity of women in certain areas. So what I think is interesting to think about is to think about where that might go, that combination of stuff, because I think we're all familiar with the female slavery scenario. I mean, it's kind of the history of our people. Our human species is really good at the whole female slavery thing. But I think that that's right. I mean, I think it's easily possible that you might get the manufacture of women. Maybe it would be not even real women. Maybe you would manufacture some kind of cyber ladies for everybody. So. We all get a Ukrainian cyber lady.
Hi. I'm so bummed I have to run and catch and leave this amazing event. But I was wondering about this question from the previous talk where somebody was asking if, you know, it seems like most people are, given millions of options, still prone to do the same old shit. So I wonder if you could talk about some of the... I don't know, some of the other forces involved that might make love in 2300 the same as it is now, right? I mean, I saw this great virtual reality installation about telegraph romance and telegraph operators, like sending messages to each other. And then they were like, and it's just like Skype. So in a way, we're doing the same thing that we were doing, you know, 100 years ago. I wonder if you could...
So how would it be the same as it is now?
Yeah, or do you think that it's necessarily like progressing some way, or maybe some of those other forces that are preventing it from?
Yeah,
progressing?
I think it's weird to talk about progress with love. I don't really know what it would mean to have progress in that area. I mean, I think the part of what I want to emphasize, and I mean, of course, anytime you project into the future, what you're really doing is talking about the present, right? So part of my point is that there is no one love even now. Sorry to Bob Marley or whatever, but there's no, I mean, even now on Earth in the contemporary period, like all over the world, love is being defined differently by different people. I mean, even here in San Francisco, like I think the way that the people in this room would define love would be very different from people in a similar gathering, you know, in Marin might define it, or
especially
in the marina,
in the kitchen.
The people in the kitchen who are like totally having like a polyamorous furry orgy back there. There's like strap-on sex going on. It's like we're gonna put it on the webcam.
The kitchen folk.
Kitchen floor. Well, Johannes is gonna be cleaning that up later. I think, you know. Sure. I mean, in the future, I mean, one of the reasons I included that first scenario about serial and parallel relationships is that I think that a lot of people in San Francisco now, I mean, I like to pretend that it's a lot of people, already are having those kinds of relationships. And I think in the future, people will be having those relationships, hopefully more often and in a more open way and in a legal way, instead of having to say like, well, this is my legal husband and here's my other husband who isn't really defined as a husband, and my wife who, oh, let's not even get into it. You know, so I think, yeah, I think there's going to be traditional relationships in the future. I think there's going to be wacky, bizarre relationships that we never would have thought of. I think there's going to be throwback relationships. I think earlier today we were talking about kind of modern primitive style relationships where like, are you serious? Is going to be jumping around naked and like painting himself blue and having sex with all of us like while grunting and stuff. And I know that that's part of your plan. And so I think, yeah, I don't... Yeah, he's already doing it. I think that that's one of the things that's great about love is that it's always, you know, even when we have like the zombie attack, we're gonna still have different kinds of love emerging out of that.
Especially with zombies. Has anyone seen here this like new zombie rape movie that's out there? I've heard about that. Someone was tweeting about it.
The girl in the basement.
The girl in the basement.
Dead
anyone?
Girl.
Huh?
It's called Dead Girl.
Dead Girl. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my.
So we're hearing that it's on PAL. Yeah, it sounds like a fantastically interesting movie. Another movie, Jennifer's Body, which it was highly underrated. I thought it was a really, really interesting movie because that's another film about a woman who's basically raped and killed and then comes back to kind of get revenge.
This was zombie
Zombie has, yeah, Zombieland has awesome zombies and awesome romance, but not between humans and zombies.
And a redneck, yeah. Yeah. Okay, of course.
Come closer.
I'm always happy to come closer to Annalie. So, in speaking about the future being a way to speak about the present, we can talk about the past to talk about the present as well. So, looking at courtly love or the troubadour tradition, do you think, as I do, that the amour de longue sort of troubadour courtly love idea of the having the marriage, but then the lover far away kind of, in a way, presages the marriage, but the long-distance poly relationship as well. And that, you know, then you were also talking about a way that that can prefigure the future.
Yeah, no, I think that the idea of courtly love just reminds us that, in fact, polyamory has existed in many different forms throughout history. I mean, including polygamy, which people always say to me when I'll talk about polyamory, like, well, that could never happen. Except for, of course, there's been this like humongously long tradition of polygamy. It's in the freaking Bible. I mean, I do think it's a way of talking about polyamory. And I think it's interesting because there's even a code. Basically, there's like a version of the ethical slut for courtly love called The Art of Courtly Love that was written by this guy, Andreas Kapelanis, during the medieval period. And it's basically like rules for how to be a good courtly lover. For those of you who've read The Ethical Slut, which is kind of the therapeutic touchy-feely guide to being poly, I mean, this is really the same thing. It even has like little lists of rules and like things that you should do to reassure your lover and all that kind of stuff. So not only have we had different forms of polyamory, we've also had different forms of self-help related to polyamory throughout time.
So there's Kapelanis, or there's Arnaud Daniel, and you know,
the
troubadour poetry is all full of, you know, how you talk to the lover,
yeah,
from far away.
Okay, do you really want to like lump polygamy and polyamory together? Because isn't polygamy usually have a lot more to do with sort of business and economic relationships and producing children and things like that? Like, aren't those things that sort of, isn't polyamory, like at least in theory, based on some sort of emotional love more than like sort of, if you look at like historical polygamy, usually it's very wealthy men having multiple wives because
women are property,
and because it's better for women in a society like that to share part of a wealthy husband than having a poor husband.
Well, again, I mean, this goes back to my point about love being defined in different ways at different times. I agree that historical polygamy and current polygamy is not the same thing as what we mean when we talk about polyamory here in San Francisco in Happy Land, where everything is consensual and we're all bisexual and everybody's equal. I guess what I meant by that was just that oftentimes people argue against the idea of polyamory by saying that it's a historically new thing that could just never catch on. And in fact, it is a historically new version of a very old thing, in the same way that contemporary monogamous marriage didn't exist 500 years ago or 600 years ago. I mean, you didn't have relationships of equality with two partners earning money and hiring a nanny or sharing childcare or anything like that. So I think polyamory is a contemporary feminist inflected version of what polygamy was. And I think polyamory can be an economic arrangement. It quite often is. I mean, people share childcare, they share housing costs together. So I think, yeah, they are different, but they are versions of the same thing. And I mean, I would never want to claim that they were exactly the same.
I can see that like on a big billboard, polyamory can be an economic what the
arrangement?
Arrangement. I can see that. Yeah. Yeah. Hope. Out there. Okay.
Share your money. Share your lovers. It's the San Francisco way.
A big applause for Annalie Newitt. Ouch. Okay. So Risa Brown will be the next speaker. So I think we'll have like a 2-3 minute break to set up the technical stuff. So, like a really stupid question. Could our next speaker please come here? I think she's not here. Oh, wow.